This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 5th of October 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Portugal votes to keep its centre-right party in charge of the purse strings, and it's a tight grip. We'll be asking how a pro-austerity government managed to stay in power. My guests, John Everard and Michael Goldfarb, will discuss that and the other day's top stories, including after more damage to Syria's ancient archaeological site of Palmyra is met with a muted response. We'll hear from Michael, who's just back from the ISIS frontline in Iraq, about whether an unhealthy sense of business as usual is creeping into the anti-ISIS campaign. And we'll be looking at the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal announced today and asking, what does it all mean? All that, plus we'll throw in our bets for this Friday's Nobel Peace Prize winners. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guest today, John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, and Michael Goldfarb, the reporter, author and broadcaster, currently writing for politico.eu. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we start today with the show in Portugal, where the country's centre-right coalition just about won yesterday's general election. The vote has been perceived as a reflection of the nation's view on austerity, with Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho's Portugal Ahead alliance emerging, well, just ahead of the socialist rival António Costa, the former mayor of Lisbon, with 37% of the vote over 32. John, let's start with you. Well, it's a odd pattern of voting across southern Europe. We've seen in Spain, you know, the rise of very strong anti-austerity parties such as Podemos. You've obviously seen what's happened in Greece. Do you think that the Portuguese have slightly watched what happened in Greece and thought, we don't want to go down that route of trying to kind of do battle again? Or is there something unique about the Portuguese psyche, do you think?
I think there's a bit of both. I mean, Portuguese tend to be conservative with a small c in any case, in a way that Greeks often aren't. Also, I mean, the spectacle of what Greece has had to go through trying to wriggle out of its obligations to the international community, particularly to the EU, I think will have caused a lot of people to think twice before trying any such thing. It is, however you cut the cake, significant that Portugal has voted effectively for continued austerity. The economy is now growing slowly, but it's growing. And the coalition have been able to say reasonably that the policies have worked and that austerity is finally bringing home the goods. Nevertheless, it's been a painful process. There has been some denting. Remember that in the last election, 2011, the coalition had just over 50% of the vote. They're down to 38 and a bit percent now. So there has been some electoral damage. Nevertheless, in terms of a bellwether for the way that Europe is moving, and particularly, I think, for what might happen in Spain in December, I think this result really is very significant.
Well, I think what's interesting is that, first of all politics is local. Even national politics within the 28-member EU is local. And so you have to look at some local things. I mean, the left has fragmented a bit. And this is very similar to what's happened in Spain as well, where Podemos has taken votes away from the traditional Socialist Party, and in the way that Syriza took a tremendous number of votes away from PASOK in Greece. So there's that to consider. There's another thing to consider, which is that for some reason, the Catholic countries on the Atlantic periphery of Europe seem happy to accept their acts of contrition. Ireland has embraced the IMF prescription and at least in a statistical way has turned itself around, even if the pain is still being felt by the people. So I think that that has to be considered in what's going on in Portugal. But there will have to be coalition negotiations, and I wonder how you see those going.
Well, it's not a question of how I see this going. They have been rumbling around all day. The Portuguese media has worked itself up into a kind of frothing frenzy over all the talks and counter-talks that have been going on. Essentially, the arithmetic means that it's going to be tough for the for Portugal à frente, for the for Portugal ahead, yes, to form a coalition without bringing in one or other of the left-wing parties. And interestingly, Passos Coelho's first move was to reach out to the main opposition, to the Socialist Party, to form a kind of grand coalition, which would have crushed all the smaller parties
so,
to the
so
side.
So there's absolute echoes of what Syriza did when they first took office earlier this year, and that they had to reach out to the right-wing party in order to have a solid enough platform to go into negotiations, which actually didn't help them very much. Greece still ended up, you know, being hammered over the head.
That's right.
But it's a similar situation.
John, do you think that part of the success of the, you know, of the anti-austerity parties in Portugal is because they have one or two good narratives? You know, they've seen huge onshoring of business to Europe, you know, for example, in the textiles industry and clothing. That's a real growth area for Portugal. They've seen a real uptick in the way that the tourism industry is run. And they've also seen a kind of, through their kind of golden visas program, which allows kind of people from all around the world to kind of enter Europe by investing in Portugal. They've seen a huge amount of money come into Porto and into Lisbon, into, you know, into buildings and infrastructure and all sorts of things.
Yes, I think all of that is right. I mean, this has basically been a competent and effective government, whatever you think of its broader policies. It's also important to remember that this is a government that has come from behind. I mean, if you had told anybody 3 months ago that Portugal à Frente was going to win these elections, they would have laughed. The socialists were massively ahead. It looked like a complete wipeout. But the good news, the steady drip of successful projects, I think has turned that round. And now, of course, it's the socialists who are in trouble. The first thing that Costa said when the results came out was that he wasn't going to resign. Just in the past hour, he has been forcibly reminded that under the constitution of the Socialist Party of Portugal, when this kind of thing happens, there has to be a party congress. And already two people have stepped forward to say they are very happy to take over from him. So he may not need to resign. He may just be shoved out.
It's interesting, both, you know, Michael raised this point, both Ireland and Portugal have something in common. It's obviously happening in Greece as well now, but have something in common, which is in moments of austerity, in tough times throughout history, what's happened is they've gone abroad. You know, that's where you see the swallow on every building, the sign that people, you know, they fled and they came back when times got better. And I think Portugal, you know, has had a huge outflow of young talent. It still has a huge number of people who are unemployed who are in the youth category. But in a way, it's also kind of sadly dealt with much of its problems by sending its people away, in a sense.
Yes, but they will come back. And it is the remittances from these people who, which have been a big part of the relative economic success of the austerity measures. I mean, the medicine has been bitter, but basically it is slowly working. The other really interesting point about all this, I think, is the position of the smaller centre parties. They, of course, if you're forming a coalition, they become gold. And we've had amazing crowing, both from the minor Democrats and from the populists and from the Greens. It's not impossible that what we're going to get is a continuation of this right-of-centre coalition, continuing with austerity, but with, for example, a significant admixture of environmental policies if they're forced into coalition with the Green Party. It'll be quite an interesting phenomenon to watch.
And I imagine, a question to either of you, I imagine that the EU will want to be seen to be a little more generous to Portugal to show that if you follow this path, you know, it's a better route than the path that was taken by Greece.
I'm not sure that there will be a big political decision to be more generous to Portugal, but the EU will make very sure that Portugal gets what it is entitled to under the various deals it has with the EU. Remember, the big bailout has now expired. Portugal has exited from that. But there's still quite a lot of EU money on the table, which I suspect Portugal will find it easier than some other countries to access.
Well, we're going to move on now. Reports over the weekend of further destruction of Syria's ancient archaeological site at Palmyra in the hands of ISIS have been met with a muted response from global leaders, seemingly becoming more and more used to the atrocities being committed by the terrorist group. Well, one of our guests today, Michael Goldfarb, as you've just heard, has returned from another front line in the conflict, Iraq, and published a piece for Politico about the region and how it appears to be falling into a habit of accepting certain norms of ISIS's hold on Palmyra. Michael, just give us your take on this sense of the new normal.
Well, at least at that end of the front, in Iraq, I mean, we first heard about ISIS.
You were in the Kurdish region.
I was in the Kurdish region, which is effectively now separated from the rest of Iraq because of ISIS sweeping in 14 months ago. And that's when we really first heard about ISIS or began to understand that it had a certain capability. And they still run Mosul, which is the second largest city in Iraq. It's 1.5 million people. So it's quite a big conurbation. But what I found interesting was that everything along that area, and it's an arc that sweeps from Kirkuk, which is where the oil fields are, up towards Turkey and then around into Syria, which is the one place where ISIS has been successfully turned back by Syrian Kurds working with Turkish Kurds, it was that everything just seemed settled. There was a lot of commerce going on. It was quite secure. There's skirmishing. Special forces are present from the coalition, which is, I mean, that's real. I mean, U.S. forces are there, British forces are there, Canadian forces are there. I believe the Germans are around as well. They work in coordination with Peshmerga outfits. They, you know, literally, that's what they do, is they skirmish. They draw out bands of ISIS fighters. They, once they're out in the open, they summon, you know, jets to come and blow them up and that sort of thing. But what I found was that no one was actually trying to roll them back. And that, to me, seemed quite astonishing.
And is that because the Kurds see, you know, a kind of literal line in the sand? They think, well, this is our territory. You know, we don't want to head down to Mosul.
First of all, I was amazed. For a year after ISIS took over Mosul and much of Anbar province, the Iraqi government continued to pay government salaries and pensions to people living inside ISIS territory, which allowed them to almost keep a kind of normality going. I mean, obviously, not normal. I mean, anybody who deviates from their view of Islam can be thrown, you know, from a 7-story high building and or executed in some other Baroque fashion. But that stopped in July, and that may change. It may make people more likely to join. Actually, I have encountered people who are, you know, Sunni and have begun to resist ISIS, which is interesting. But what I came away thinking was, it seems to me that Western strategy, and this is up till last week when the Russians got involved, was we solve Syria first. And if we solve Syria, then we can address ISIS. Not seeing them as two separate problems, not seeing ISIS as being something that actually is, even though they're fewer in number and they're killing fewer people, they are the global reach. They're the ones who are disturbing the global Islamic Ummah, drawing young people from Western countries into the region to fight, spreading an ideology of hatred. And I was really quite surprised that there hasn't been more done to try and roll them back. The Kurds proved they could do it at Kobani with considerable help. There's no reason to think they couldn't be doing this in other parts of, you know, what's called the caliphate, but really is just a vast swathe of desert that is under the control of this group of murderers.
John, you know, do you think that's fair that it's in the new normal? It certainly seems to be perplexing people in Moscow, in Washington, in Paris, in London. There's a sense that something must be done. Maybe not because of what's happening on the ground, but because of what we're seeing happening in Europe, that the number of refugees coming because of, you know, Assad and the work of ISIS on the ground as well. That's the reason that something will be done eventually. That, you know, as Michael said, if they can solve the situation in Syria, then that would lead potentially to the downfall of ISIS elsewhere.
I'm not privy to these decisions. Obviously, I would guess that underlying this rather erratic behavior that Michael described, there are probably simply resource constraints, that we just don't have enough men, money, everything else to deal with ISIS and with Syria simultaneously. And yes, okay, someone has made the decision that we have to do Syria first, which after the Russian intervention is going to be much more difficult than first appeared. Whether that was a wise decision or not, I mean, I guess it's too early to say. But I would hazard a guess that that is actually what is going on. As Michael rightly points out, I mean, the outreach is ISIS. I mean, they're the ones with the ideology. But it is the Syrians who are killing people. I think, you know, over 11,000 dead in Syria, as opposed to, I think, less than 2,000 so far.
It's a grotesque ratio to quote, but it's about 10 to 1.
Right.
So while, you know, for every, you know, Western journalist who is grotesquely butchered, you get a tremendous amount of interest in this entity, ISIS. But the reality on the ground in Syria is that the regime is just still in a mode of wholesale slaughter. And that's what's creating the problem that's knocking on into Europe, where there are, you know, potentially 1.5 million people trying to get here. And many of them will end up being disappointed at the borders, I should think.
And Michael, tell me, when you were in the Kurdish region of Iraq, in Kurdistan, was the feeling there that, you know, they had their territory and they would hopefully win over more territory, you know, in Syria, or at least hold the territory in Syria, not come under attack from, you know, from, by Turks or anybody else? But they didn't really have any ambition to, you know, to be part of a wider fight in Iraq.
Well, look, the Iraqi Kurds are in a very difficult situation vis-a-vis Turkey. Turkey is essentially making war on its own Kurdish population at the moment. And it's underreported because the Turks have pretty much got rid of all the Western journalists who were down in southeastern Turkey trying to cover what they're doing. But the Iraqi Kurds do a lot of business. They ship oil through Turkey. That oil is essentially their financial lifeline. And, you know, the Turks do a lot of business back into Iraq via Kurdistan. So it's a very odd space. I think, you know, the Kurdish regional government is in no position to tell the Turks to stop doing what they're doing to their brother Kurds in Turkey. And they leave the Syrians alone. What's odd is that the Obama administration, which has been all over the place on this issue for 4 years, desperately wanted to get Incirlik Air Base, which is in southern Turkey, as the launch point for its fighter jets. And once Prime Minister Erdogan, President Erdogan of Turkey, agreed to that, then you began to see all this fighting against his own Kurds. And it's almost as if there was an understanding. It's, you can use Incirlik, but don't interfere with my internal terrorist problem, or whatever he calls it. And the Iraqi Kurds are on the outside of that, and they can't really get involved. There's resentment, certainly. But, you know, the whole situation is out there is remarkably fluid. And I don't mean to be sanguine about it, but it's like you can make an alliance for this week if it helps you gain some tactical advantage, but then you fall out with the people you're in alliance with. And in the meantime, just to come back to John's point, you know, the Iraqi Kurds certainly do not have the military wherewithal to take the fight directly to ISIS. The ISIS groups they face on what until recently was their territory. And so they're reliant then on the United States and the coalition bombers. They're reliant on other people. And so you end up with this kind of frozen situation in which a little happens, a little doesn't happen. You know what your opponents are capable of and what they're not capable of. And so, you know, we're talking about this, and we're no nearer a solution for either ISIS or the disintegration of Syria.
I think it's clear from what you're saying that the key to so much of this is Turkey. And, of course, we're having this conversation while Erdogan is in Brussels hammering out a deal, probably, with European leaders. It'll be interesting to see whether that affects Turkey's action over the next several weeks.
Mike, what do you make of the focus on Palmyra? It's certainly a cultural tragedy. But in a way, when you say there are 11,000 people have died, you know, just at the hands of the regime in Syria, it's a bit of a strange thing to focus on the archaeological loss when you're losing so many human beings.
Well, what's interesting is that this goes to the heart of the ISIS strategy. They are 21st century in terms of propaganda. They're the best propagandists around. And you notice that they're blowing these things up almost like, you know, card players playing a card. They don't play the whole hand. I mean, when they went into Palmyra, everybody was concerned because, you know, and it does have, I mean, we are concerned about the human beings who are being murdered, but we're also concerned about the human heritage, which is under threat. They understand the symbolic nature of that, but they also understand that they can only blow it up once. So they're doing it in bits and pieces. And whenever they're under pressure, they'll blow up a building. So I wonder if we can read the situation as, well, maybe they are concerned that the Russians are going to start hammering them, so they will start blowing up buildings. But they won't blow them up all at once. They'll go a bit at a time, because this is their card. It's their propaganda card.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, a new trade agreement that affects 40% of the world's economy. Who, though, and why?
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Today, a trade deal 5 years in the making was announced. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is an agreement between the US, Japan and 10 other Pacific Rim countries that is set to affect around 40% of the world's economy, geared towards removing economic barriers between the nations. It's being criticised already for a bias against large corporations. So will the TPP agreement be a real help to Pacific economies or not? John, there's a simple question for you.
Yes, this is really big news.
Answer that one.
It's going to make a very big difference to all the 12 economies that have signed up to TPP. I mean, one of the sad things we've seen over the last 5 years, perhaps 10, is the slowdown in the freeing up of international trade. The WTO round to kind of run into the sand and not really had the impact they hoped for. The TPP signature, of course, doesn't include everybody in WTO, but it's still 40% of the world economy. It's an awful lot of people. And scrapping, I think, 18,000 that they've counted, different trade inhibitors, is going to make trade much more efficient and create a great, great deal of wealth in those countries. That's the economic aspect. Can I talk about politics?
I know where you're going. You're going to bring in China, aren't you?
Well, we didn't bring in China. That's precisely the point.
I know.
Yes.
They're left waiting.
They are left not just waiting. I don't think they're
going to get
in.
But they were invited to the party.
They were at the outset. Remember, we've been negotiating this thing for 8 years. And 8 years ago, China was invited and said no. I doubt if China would have been invited in the first place were we to restart negotiations now. But it means that, crucially, that Japanese goods now have a competitive edge in the US market that is denied Chinese goods. It also, we focus on Asia. In Latin America, there's been a lot recently about how Brazil may be losing its primacy to Mexico in the region. Mexico is part of TPP, Brazil isn't. Therefore, Mexican goods get a cost advantage in the big developed markets that Brazilian ones don't. That too is going to tell.
Michael, how do we make TPP sound fun for people? So it's going to change how people, what people pay for their food, for their drugs. But there have been some real battles here. One of which is
speaking
around
drugs.
Yeah, pharmaceuticals, for example.
Well, do you know, 20 plus years ago, I actually lost three nights sleep covering the end of the GATT round, which created the WTO. I was in Geneva for that. I'm still trying to figure out what that was about, and I have not done so. That's why they sent me off to start covering conflicts. You're not an economics correspondent. It seems to me that somewhere, and because I haven't been following it very closely, the big pharmaceutical companies headquartered in the U.S. have been lobbying very hard for the longest possible copyright, or it would be copyright, you know,
pay protection
on their the drugs that they develop. And it seems as if they've been forced to give a bit on that. And that's why there's been a successful conclusion announced today. Instead of getting the 15 years, I think they were asking for 12 to 15 years, I think they may have to settle for 5 to 8 years. And that will make a big difference. And it will make a big difference in and again, this is, it's almost about the economics. I mean, so many of the countries, you know, they need access to generic drugs because they have big national health systems, sort of like we have here. And that will make a big difference because it means that they can be manufactured elsewhere. And that, I think, is important. Beyond that, the other economic issues is the political one, which is there is just an intense anti-globalization feeling. Too many people have felt that their jobs have been offshored. And what's interesting, of course, is that there are people in Mexico who will feel that their jobs have been offshored as well and will be concerned that by creating yet lower tariffs, that will mean that jobs will go to the places of lowest wages. And so it'll be interesting to see what the politics of this are in terms of getting it through national parliaments, Congress, for example.
There's going to be a lot of fighting. Mexico is an interesting example because, of course, within the TPP countries, the lowest wage area tends to be southern Mexico. So you're actually seeing jobs migrate within the country rather than go be offshore completely. Though telling that to an auto worker in northern Mexico may be rather cold comfort. The other big story of TPP that we haven't even touched on yet is, of course, the internet.
I've got one more story to get in before the end of the show, so don't go too in deep here. Come on,
okay, off we go. Just quickly. TPP imposes effectively United States standards on internet protection and privacy across all the TPP countries. In some cases, this means that it's more difficult to post stuff to the internet and more difficult to circulate things. But crucially, it means there's now free internet in countries like Vietnam and Malaysia, which is quite a breakthrough.
And the other good news is if you're an elephant, you're probably smiling today because apparently there's tougher restrictions on the trade of ivory and endangered animals. Now, talking about lots of fighting, the Nobel Peace Prize is coming up. Does it mean anything anymore?
Yawn.
Come on. No, so apparently, here's who's tipped already. Angela Merkel.
It's the preemptive thing. You know, we'll give this. They started giving the Peace Prize preemptively when they gave it to President Obama, when he was just months in office, for the simple fact of having been elected and having made a very interesting speech in Cairo. You were saying Merkel here about the UNHCR.
Well, because of the refugee element. You know,
and just think 4 months ago, there was no chance because she was sacrificing the entire people of Greece on the God austerity's altar. It's a very interesting turnaround for Angela Merkel. I worry about this. I mean, I think it's much better when they give the Peace Prize to an organization that has been at the front line and has decades and decades of work, an NGO that has decades and decades of work actually bringing peace, if only to a small area of the world, rather than in some grand strategic way.
Yes. John, the Pope, what about the Pope? Does he deserve it?
Not yet. I don't think he deserves it. Frankly, I don't think Angela Merkel deserves it either. I'm with Michael on this. I think, you know, let's pick out the unsung heroes.
I hope no thunderbolts strike us during the next few moments.
Well, we're protected by the thunderbolt-proof studio we're sitting in. What worries me is that effectively candidates are being assessed on just how fiercely they've defended the rights of refugees to cross Europe. Angela Merkel, of course, has been at the forefront. Various others are in the ring for that. At a time when all these policies are being severely criticized. Is this really the way to go? Does it matter anyway? Frankly, who cares these days about the Nobel Peace Prize? Let me ask you both, who won it last year?
I haven't got a clue.
No, it was Malala and
somebody
else whose name we've already forgotten. Yes. The same's going to happen in future. Yeah. There was a time when this prize really mattered, when it was given to people who fought Soviet oppression and so on. Frankly, these days, I don't think it does.
So neither of you have a top tip for somebody who could win it?
No.
No? Michael, you hesitated.
No. I mean, the list seems obvious, and because they've been going for, like I say, these preemptive things, well, we encourage Angela Merkel's point of view, therefore we'll give it to Merkel, the UNHCR. It's a big organization. I'd much rather they find some group of people who have been working in the camps in Jordan and in Turkey for the last 4 years helping people rather than these big organizations or the Chancellor
of
Germany.
Okay, well, a risk of upsetting and having no peace in the studio. We're going to have to stop it there. I think I'd give it to the inventor of toast. That's helped more people make peace in the morning than anything else. But Michael Goldfarb, Farb even, and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Inez Fresnay and by Ada McLaughlin, and also by Antonia Martz-Hauser. But for me, goodbye.